Narayana Namaskritcha Narantaiva Narottamam Evam Sarasvati Vyasam Dito Jayamudiraya Nastaprayesu Bhadresu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttamas Lokir Bhakti Bhavati Naishtiki Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Continuation of reading from the chapter Lord Krishna's Entrance into Dwarka, Canto 1, Chapter 11, Text Number 36. Udama Bhava Visunamala Valgu Hasa Vridava Loka Nihato Madana Pi Yasham Samuya Chapam Ajahat Pramodottamas Pramodottamas Yasendriyam Vimaititum Kuhakaya Na Seko Udama Bhavapisu Namala Bhaguhasa Vidavaloka Nihato Madana Piyasham Pramukhya chapa ajahat pramado tamasa Yasindriyam vima hitum kuhakaya na sekum Udama baba pisuna malava guhasa Vidavaloka nihato madana piyasam Samuya chapa haja pravamoda tamasta Yasindriyam vimahitum kuhakaya naseku
Thank you.
Anyone else? The children? Odama.
Odama.
Very grave.
Very grave.
Baba.
Baba.
Expression.
Expression.
Pisuna.
Pisuna.
Exciting.
Exciting.
Amala.
Amala.
Spotless.
Spotless.
Vagu.
Vagu.
Hasa.
Hasa.
Beautiful smiling.
Brida,
corner of the eye.
Corner of the eye.
Avaloka,
looking.
Nihata,
conquered.
Madanaha,
Cupid.
Or Mandana, the great tolerant Shiva. Api,
Api,
also,
also.
Yasham,
Yasham,
whose,
Samhuya,
Samhuya, being empowered by,
being empowered by.
Japam,
Japam,
bowls. Ajahat,
Ajahat,
gave up,
gave up.
Pramara,
Pramara,
women.
Women.
Who maddens,
matters.
Uttamaha,
Uttamaha,
of high grade.
Ta,
all.
Oh.
Yasya,
Yasya,
whose.
Indriyam,
senses.
Vimat hitum,
too perturbed. Kuhakai,
Kuhakai.
By magical feats.
By magical feats.
Na.
Na.
Never.
Never.
Sekun.
Sekun.
Was able.
Was able.
Translation. Although the queen's beautiful smiles and putative glances were all spotless and exciting, and although they could conquer Cupid himself by making him give up his bow in attraction and frustration, and although even the tolerant Shiva could fall victim to them, still, despite all their magical feats and attractions, they could not agitate the senses of the Lord. Report by Srila Prabhupada. The path of salvation, or the path going back to Godhead, always forbids the association of women. And the complete Sanatana Dharma, or Varnashram Dharma, scheme forbids or restricts association with women. How then can one be accepted as the Supreme Personality of Godhead who is addicted to more than 16,000 wives? This question may be relevantly raised by inquisitive persons, really anxious to know about the transcendental nature of the Supreme Lord. And to answer such question, the sages at Namasairanya have discussed the transcendental cares of the Lord in this and in the following verses. It is clear herein that the feminine attractive features which can conquer Cupid or even the supermost tolerant Lord Shiva could not conquer the senses of the Lord. Cupid's business is to invoke mundane lust. The whole universe is moving, being agitated by Cupid's arrows. The activities of the world are being carried on by the central attraction of male and female. A male is searching after a mate to his liking, and the female is looking after a suitable mate. This is the way of material stimulus. And as soon as a male is combined with a female, the material bondage of the living being is at once tightly interlocked by sex relations. And as a result of this, both the male and female's attraction for sweet home, motherland, bodily offspring, society and friendship, and accumulation of wealth becomes the illusory field of activities. And thus a false but infallible attraction for the temporary material existence, the which is full of miseries, is manifest. Those who are therefore in the path of salvation, going back to Godhead, are especially advised by all scriptures' instructions to become free from such paraphernalia of material attraction. And that is possible only by the association of the devotees of the Lord, who are called the Mahatmas. Cupid throws his arrows upon the living beings to make them mad after the opposite sex, whether the party is actually beautiful or not. Cupid's provocations are going on, even among beastly society, who are ugly looking in the estimation of the civilized nation. Thus, Cupid's influence is exerted even amongst the ugliest forms, or to speak of the most perfect beauties. Lord Shiva, who is considered to be the most tolerant, and also struck by Cupid's arrows, was also struck by Cupid's arrows, because he also became mad after who? The Mohini incarnation of the Lord, and acknowledged himself to be defeated. Cupid, however, was himself captivated by the grave and exciting dealings of the goddesses of fortune, and he voluntarily gave up his bow and his arrow in a spirit of frustration. Such was the beauty and attraction of the queens of Lord Krishna, yet they could not disturb the transcendental senses of the Lord. This is because the Lord is all perfect, Atmaram, or self-sufficient. He does not require anyone's extraneous help for his personal satisfaction. Therefore, the queens could not satisfy the Lord by their feminine attractiveness, but they satisfied him by their sincere affection and service. Only by the unalloyed transcendental loving service could they satisfy the Lord, and the Lord was pleased to treat them as wives in reciprocation. Thus, being satisfied by their unalloyed service only, the Lord reciprocated the service just like a devout husband. Otherwise, he had no business becoming the husband of so many wives. He is the husband of everyone, but to one who accepts him as such, he reciprocates. This unalloyed affection for the Lord is never to be compared to mundane lust. It is purely transcendental, and the grave dealings which the queens displayed in natural feminine ways were also transcendental, because the feelings were expressed out of transcendental ecstasy. It is already explained in the previous verse that the Lord appeared like a mundane husband, but faction, his relationship with his wives, were transcendentally pure and unconditional by the modes of material nature. So we see great power here. It's how the wives of the Lord were distinctly attractive, were very powerful by their feminine features. But what was most prominent and what was captivating that even attracted the Lord, Prabhupada explained, was their service, the purity of their service. And of course, service rendered with intense dedication, unalloyed, is offered to Krishna, we know is most attractive, the most attractive aspect of existence, because everything else can be considered somewhat relative. Prabhupada is saying how this attraction between the opposite sex is so powerful that even in cultures or species that he gives the word unattractive, that still the attraction is there. Of course, attraction is relative based on the physiognomy. What is considered to be often attractive in one culture is not necessarily the same. There's some cultures that a woman is considered, like especially in ancient time in China, a woman was as attractive as she had small feet. And some women would go to tremendous austerities, literally torturing themselves, making their tying their feet up, the feet would be small and pointed in such a way as their toes. And men were just totally fascinated. Special feet. And in some places, a man is considered very attractive if he is very strong, very stout. Just like you can see the difference when it comes, you know, to modeling. In some countries, what would be considered to be a good-sized woman would be considered fat in another country. And like here in Australia and American places, in some places, such woman who now is considered to be ideal size, we consider it very skinny. It's like in some, for instance, like in Africa, if a woman is big, she's considered to be very attractive because it's a sign that she's eating nicely and wealth is there and opulence is there. And so the models and the signs of people and the posters and things, what we consider to be actually quite fat. They would see a woman like the size of a model in America or in Europe, they would think, oh, she's suffering from malnutrition. She eats. Why don't the husband take care of her? You know, feed her. She's so thin. Such. But it's so relative. In some places, people do things to make change their bodies to what's considered to be attractive. And now, of course, plastic surgery is a tremendous booming business because people are constantly altering their bodies, just like some folks. Just like people change cars every so often. But the point is, this principle is very powerful, and it's powerful because it's natural. It's very natural to seek after relationship, affection. The question is, what is the nature of the sambandha? What is the nature of the relationship? Is it a genuine, caring, selfless, service type of relationship? Or the relationship is based on some kind of exploitation? Whether it's people of the same gender, same sex as friends, or whether it's conjugal, the opposite sex or whatever, that all relationships, one has to look close to see what really is the quality, what is the caliber of the relationship. How much is it really an authentic relationship where two people, concerns, perceptions, individuality, needs are genuinely being addressed based on what will enhance their self-actualization or will help to move them more toward transcending. Because other than the spiritual world, there's really no such thing as a neutral relationship. In a sense that any kind of associations, there is either a helping one for more liberation and service, that is, a relationship is either helping one to become more Krishna conscious, or it's procrastination or stagnation. There's no such thing as neutral. When people associate, there's a sharing. And so there's a sharing of consciousness, there's a sharing of subtle presence, and just with what we bring to a relationship has so much to do with what we're presently thinking and aspiring for, and so many things and karmic patterns from the past. So when people associate, they're exchanging energies and consciousness. And so this is why some people you interact with, and some places you go, and you just feel drained, zapped, because the nature of their energy and their consciousness is that it's like a vampire who is draining and pulling on one's energies. Some places there's so much simple activity that there is such collective draining consciousness just to go into such places. The modes are very intense. We come to pilgrimage places, we come to temples, we come to someone's home who's devotional. The atmosphere is surcharged in various ways with so many things that can enhance our devotion. Because the paraphernalia is sending out a message to us, what we see here, all of these things that our senses are connected with isn't being internalized to some extent. But more important is what people are thinking in those environments. What kind of mental culture is pervading. And so, when there is a culture that is really based on trying to be about things that are more sanatana or eternal, then it is very beneficial. And where there is an atmosphere that is dominant, where people are dominantly involved in just, you know, pursuance of lust, is very degrading and dangerous. So not only do certain people have, all of us, everybody has different aggregate conscious effect on the environment. Also certain environments are distinctly having a certain type of mood. But even we see, even different times of the day, having different kinds of influences. We know that certain times that there's more sort of pious devas who have more presence. And we know that like in the Brahma Murti hour, these times are very special. Because not only because people are not so active running after sense gratification, not so much mundane sounds, not so much deviations and whatnot, but at the same time, there are times when there is an influence that's pervading the planet by caretakers, those who have stewardship, who had more potency, more spiritual potency. It's not an accident that many people who do satanic rituals and do worship to Durga and other things, they do them, you know, at midnight. They do them late in those kind of hours because there is more influence of a negative nature. So many crimes and things happen during that time. These days, people sometimes don't care. Perhaps in the middle of the morning. But more times that the energy levels are lower in such ways. So, Cupid is using or directing energy to ignite people's move toward attraction and whatnot. And so in many ways, one finds themselves being attracted, and that is natural in the sense that we are social entities. And so we are always pursuing some type of a sangha. And if it's not it's religious, and it can be some type of recreation or social entertainment arrangement, or it can be sports, or it can be gangs, or whatever. But there's always a need for some type of community. And so we either have some community that helps us, reminding us about Sanatana Dharma, or we have some type of associations that really, really do the opposite. They keep us covered over more and more. So we have to look close at ourselves and what we give to the environment. We have to look close at who and what we're associating with to really see. Is the association of a nature that it is inspiring one to try to be more Krishna conscious? Or the association of a nature that is encouraging one to engage in sense gratification? Is association the kind of association that the friendship is based on pajava? Is it based on cynicism? Many people, their friendship is based on cynicism. Many people, their friendship is based on some problem, some wound. So many support groups, people have relationships based on the fact that they're victims, they're children of alcoholic parents, they're experiencing abandonment. And these are realities, but the unfortunate thing is that because the association is based on that, they often have no identity outside of that particular problem. And so they come together and basically they help each other for a while. And then it becomes the opposite. Then it becomes a sense where people hold each other down to some problems and issues in their lives and their identity and their relationships and their associations. This is also my friend who's also an alcoholic. This is also my friend who just... And so the friendship becomes based on such things. But we notice when devotees get in the Maya, they form friendships with other devotees who are in Maya. According to the degree of Maya they're in, they search out relationships that help to reinforce the kind of Maya they have accepted. Because one needs to have others somehow to help to justify what they're doing, etc. And so, we always want to somehow look for association, higher association, association that's going to assist us in becoming more fixed about what our goals are. Anytime we associate with each other, and somehow we don't stimulate each other to come up to a higher standard, then that's violence. Anytime we associate with someone, and our association is of such a nature that it encourages somebody to be speculative, it encourages somebody to break principles, it encourages somebody to minimize the ninefold process, we have created, imposed violence on such person, and have not been the servant of service. Anytime that we take somebody's association who is deviant, we are foolish. We're foolish. We're simply cheating ourselves. Neither one should be arrogant, neither one should be an elitist. But if there's association with somebody who's in Maya, then if we're not able to help that person, we're just playing games and hurting ourselves in the process, having to be connected with such enemies. And sometimes it's good to avoid such people, letting them know that my concern and care for you is so intense that I in no way can be around you, seeing you hurt yourself and do such harm to yourself in such ways. That we do not reinforce such situation. At the same time, we compassionately send a message that stop cheating yourself, stop sabotaging the process, stop creating from your own anarthas and weeds, polluting the environment. It makes it more, in general, difficult for people to execute their Krishna consciousness. Where their environments, where there is so much looseness or deviation, then it has its way of contaminating the general atmosphere. And it makes it more difficult for each person who is trying to exist in the environment. The converse of that is, of course, very powerful. Everywhere where there is someone who's trying with more dedication and perseverance and not being lazy or a coward. Because in one sense, when we're in Maya, two distinct things are going on. We're lazy, and we're a coward. We're lazy because everything is there to answer any problems, any concern we have. The Shastra is sending us an indicators of what it should be done, how it should be done, why things happen, why things go on, good and bad, and still what is to be understood. And this is why we have all these great Nitya sinners who come into the world. We read about them in Chaitanya Bhagavat, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, in Bhagavatam. For what? Why are they appearing? So that we can know what is to be done in this hellish world with all of these difficulties and problems. So when we're in Maya, it means that we're lazy, that we have not used our intelligence and mind to reach out for the prescription or the antidote or the solace. It also means that we are very selfish, because when we're in Maya, we're also saying pretty much to the environment, especially to those that we love, we're saying, I don't give a damn. I want to do what I want to do. I don't really care that much about you. Because when we associate with each other, we are sharing consciousness. So when we're in Maya, we're saying to our children, to our wife, to our husband, or to our associates, we're saying, I don't really care about you. I just want to do what I want to do. And whatever feels good for me at this time, I don't care. I don't care about contaminating the situation, the environment. I don't care about being an improper role model, my children. I don't care about what the great acharyas have reached out and struggled to try to make available for us. I don't feel that it's important for me that I have to be authentic. It's important for me that I have to represent, although I made pledges and vows to the Lord and to the fire, and to Agni, and to the Assembly of Devotees, and to my Guru, that I'm going to be a representative by following the formulas and regulations. But, so what? So, how is the Lord supposed to respond to one who has received mercy, have received blessings, have been singled out in a very special way, and is so void of gratitude, and has so lack of respect and consideration about others? If we are, at least with character, integrity, just Dharma in general, then even when we feel some tendencies to go into Maya, we won't, because we'll think, I don't want to offend my temple president who's trying hard to encourage me. I don't want to offend my wife who is so much dependent on me and thinking that I'm more responsible than I am. I don't want to offend or discourage my mother because she has so much affection for me. So, if we just a little bit more selfless, one gets stronger by just considering what it means to others. It's like in the case of, you know, adolescent children. Tendency is, you know, become deviant. Harming other devoted children. Especially because of peer pressure. But that child who is wanting and willing to engage in something illicit or take some intoxication, the senses, the mind, and the intelligence are all going in that direction. After all, my friends are doing it, so many people are doing it, could not be so bad. After all, what's the problem? I just do it sometimes. After all, what's the problem? Nobody's going to know. But now, that child is thinking, but in no way would I want to see my mother, my pita, hurt by knowing about my deviation, or being aware, etc. And so the child thinks, even though I want to do this, but my love is so much for my Mata and Pita that I cannot think of seeing the pain that I will give them. And then the person becomes empowered not to give in into such. So as we are more selfless or thinking less of just ourselves in some sovereign way based on sense gratification, it becomes easier to be able to maintain a higher standard. But if we right out just don't care that much, then what can be done? And that means more material bodies, because spiritual life is about real compassion and caring and selflessness. And so we're really not trying to be about that. We're really in the wrong society. There's so many societies that are carnal funded. There's so many societies where people are just trying to be survivalists, and they're just trying to get, trying to have moksha for themselves. They're trying to develop city powers, and they make alliances and whatnot, but really the only thing they're thinking about is how to be God, or how to have some of the shakti of the Lord. There are so many societies where that is. Well, there's so many societies where people engage in all kinds of rituals, various types of religions, all kinds of rituals, because they're trying to bribe the Lord. They're trying to flatter Him, trying to ingratiate Him, and they're considering, I've done this, now what do you want to do for me? I pray, I fast, I went on Hajj, I went on pilgrimage, I've made so much, Salat, I've done through all kinds of yajnas. Now, okay, what are you going to do for me? And so, if we're really thinking that way, there's places we can get more benefit, through the benefit. But the process of bhakti, as Krishna says, yes, bhakti mama bhijanadi, only by devotion can I really be understood as I am. So, and he says, Teshasa Tatayu Tadam Bhagatam Yuri Purvaka, Idam Yuinam Yantate, Teshasa Tatayu Tadam, those who worship me with love and devotion in a consistent and persevering way, Krishna says, I will personally give them myself. I will personally give them the knowledge. I will personally be active in their lives because they are all for me, and therefore I'll be all for them. So he doesn't say those who worship me with ill intent, ulterior motives, those who worship me with all kinds of mishra, those who worship me with jnana mishra bhakti. Bhakti is there, but they're more connected with just trying to know, they're trying to become. Those who worship me with karma mishra bhakti, they are connected, but still there's so much fruitative mindset and actions. Those who worship me with yoga mishra bhakti, bhakti is there, but still there's too much fascination with mysticism, the paranormal, etc. None of those, Krishna says, can really have him and be attractive as these women are who have attracted him. Although they have so much wonderful attractive features, this was not to were able to capture the Lord, but what captured him was in fact their wonderful service and service attitude. So as we try to think more about what we say and do and what effect it has on others, then we become more meticulous about trying to do the right thing in the right way. But also we get great deal of realization, because Krishna facilitates us to the degree that we are selfless and concerned and using what we have nicely, then he gives us more. So when he sees that we are definitely trying to represent him in the best way that we can, we're not minimizing the boon that has come to us to participate in this royal path, then things will become more and more exciting. And when not, we'll literally become dry. We'll just find ourselves becoming dry, that what chanting our rounds becomes really laborious, and we can barely get 3-4 rounds done because we have no taste. Coming to see the Lord, the darshan, becomes just another darsha, another arti, now another tulsi puja, and we just have no taste. Like, I'm sure you have probably several people here on the farm who practically never come for class, practically never come for arti, surely hardly ever come for mangala arti. And in some cases, yes, some work, some schedule, a lot of children, some issues, But in many cases, it's that the taste is just not there. And after a while, if the taste is not there, then gradually becomes more and more taste for sense gratification, and first watching TV all day, and later a little drugs, and the next thing become attracted to somebody else's wife, somebody else's husband, because we are constantly looking for the ruchi. We must have taste. And if we don't have the taste based on spiritual nourishment, there's going to be emptiness, and it's only a matter of short time before we start filling the emptiness with something else. Krishna consciousness is a science. And so it is so much based on being able to first engage in Vaidhi Bhakti, where we are allowing the senses to be captured, where they're gradually getting purified. But the senses are not involving themselves in the culture of devotion, then where are they going to go? They're going to go first back to past habits and pleasures and stimulation. Because even past things, even though we intellectually understand they're not eternally fulfilling, but they gave us some chapala sukha, they gave us some temporary stimulation. And notice what's also when someone loose, often they go right back to so many things that they were doing 10, 20 years ago before they joined, because that there was some security, some experiences, some stimulation. And so what happens is that if we're not tasting and trying to nourish the soul more, then we'll be nourishing again the senses. Just like somebody, you know, somebody who's an addict and they have addiction. And one of the main ways of being free from the addiction is transformation. You can't just stop it and consider that addiction is going to go away. You have to replace it. Some other activities and absorption, the energy has to go somewhere. And so to the degree that somebody is not coming around for association, they're not coming to hear, they're not coming to see for the Lord, then what's happening? Means every time the curtain opens and we're thinking that we're the seers, but we're being seen. We're the dressed up. So what happens is that Radha Govindananda, they're looking out and they say, oh, okay. So you're still not coming to see me. Okay. You're still not coming to do service. Okay. You're still not trying to really put me in the center of your life. So why should I offer myself to you? Why should I give you myself when what you are asking for by your actions is that you're asking for my lower nature, you're asking for Maya. And so why should Krishna protect us from Maya when our actions are saying that we're really not wanting see protection? And then more and more Maya is offering, and you know, we start accepting. It's very wonderful. Here we have such wonderful deities. We have three sets of deities, three altars, and many ways to be able to think of the Lord, many ways to be able to serve the Lord. But because we have such presence of the Lord, this is very powerful. This is also very dangerous. This is why sometimes we see that in some systems there is no deity. In some cases, the propagators of the system were aware of some intimacy of personal service to the Lord, but did not offer it because people making offenses, being abusive, they would electrocute themselves by having something so powerful and not using it. Krishna consciousness has so many things of that nature. It's very powerful and very dangerous. It's like you've seen, devotees who go to Vrindavan, they go to sacred pilgrimage places, they come back and they have a chronic sickness for the rest of their life. Or they make some offense, and because they're in the holy dham, they get some immediate type of reaction. Well, similarly, someone can be involved in the process on a spiritual journey. They come into the Vaishnava connection. They can make more advancement. They can do more harm to their spiritual life than they ever could. Because the impersonalists will and cannot dress the deities or feed the deities because they don't even accept the deities. They can't come that close. But the devotee can put salt into the sweet rice instead of sugar. The devotee can have intense negative mentality, offensive mentality, and bring that on the altar and cause themselves some disturbance. The devotee can be in the community and now be having illicit sex or smoking drugs or whatever, and now they're going to hurt themselves so much. because they've come so close. They come right into Krishna's direct, or Lord Chaitanya's, part of, they've been enrolled in Lord Chaitanya's internal army. And they come so close to, you know, to be so deep. So there's consequence. That's why we have some people falling down. Because falling down is a sign that Krishna consciousness works. Especially with big people falling down, it's a sign that Krishna consciousness works. It's a sign that if someone is deviant, someone does not do the right thing, someone is hypocritical, then Krishna has inbuilt systems to be able to expose or to help the person by exposing them. There's really no cheating. So when we cheat, we may get a little interval where the Lord has missed a chance, hopefully, to work on ourselves and change. If we don't, it smashes us. And so every time we see somebody fall, it's a sign that Krishna consciousness works. Because what is a sign of is that they were doing something that was outside of what is proper Krishna consciousness, and that it didn't just get away. If you take medicine, it doesn't matter whether it doesn't matter what the medicine is, then it means the medicine is not good. If it doesn't help you, there's something's wrong with it. If you take it the wrong way, to give you some problems, either it doesn't work or you get some reaction. And so Krishna consciousness medicine, because it does work, if we take it, we get benefit. If we don't, then we suffer. We have thousands of devotees, more devotees outside of Krishna consciousness than inside of Krishna consciousness. Those who made vows. So why is that going on? It means so many devotees, they make those vows and they come and they participate for a while, and after a while they lose faith for all kinds of reasons. But there's no reason for anybody to lose faith ultimately other than their own weakness. Because if we lose faith because somebody treats us wrong, that's a sign of ugliness, a sign of lack of being stable. We lose faith because we had sickness, because we had divorce, even if we had rule fall down, which is most devastating. Most people do lose faith and become wounded in most cases for the rest of their Krishna consciousness. But why is it one person has a guru who falls down and they go right back now to gambling, illicit sex, intoxications, all kinds of things? Another person has a guru who falls down and now they become more shastric, become more serious about their service, become more attentive about their own life, seeing the delegate of Krishna, the delegates see of Maya. Same thing happened to both parties, but they're taking a total different mood. Because it has to do also with their own adhikar, their own character, credit, sukriti, jnana sukriti, has to do with themselves. And so the less that we are stable, then the more difficult it is when something rocks our boat. But the stronger the boat is, or the stronger desire to fix something, then when there's some rocking, one bridges in stronger. So when you're on the airplane, and then there's some turmoil, and turbulence, yes. And the siren comes on, or the stewardess makes an announcement. Buckle up your seatbelt. So it's a sign that there's turbulence, so one is supposed to situate themselves in stronger. But somebody can be erratic. And when the turbulence is there, they jump up, they want to run, they want to get out of here, get me out of here, where's the closer the door, etc. And so turbulence means it's a time now to reinforce our situation, to consolidate our position. It's not a time that we now take shelter of just that we should be trying to run away from. So, because the women were so fixed in their service and dedicated, then we see that Krishna was attracted. Now, earlier Prabhupada says here a statement that the path of salvation of going back to Godhead always forbids the association of women. Why do we have these kinds of statements constantly appearing in the Shastra? Why do we have discussions that women are less intelligent? Why do we have that one who is embarking upon spiritual life, one of the most dangerous things is the association of women? Let's look at that for 5 minutes or so. Sometimes when Prabhupada is saying women, he's referring to women for men and men for women. And times that he's referring to the opposite sex. But at the same time, we see here in this scripture, in this purport, distinctly that Shiva, who is very tolerant and powerful, was overwhelmed by the form of Mohini, women form, incarnation. Here we see that Cupid himself was overwhelmed by the form and attraction of women. So what we're really dealing with is that women are more powerful than men. And because they're more powerful than men, they are dangerous when they're materially absorbed, materially connected, materially influenced. Women are the major carriers of the culture. And let's look at this from a scientific point of view, and then spiritual, and then a spiritual connection. Women, practically every place on this planet, live longer than men. I'm sure your statistics here is probably similar to Europe and America, where the average woman is living about 7 years longer than the average man. Women have better use of both hemispheres of their brain than men. Women have better sensory perception in terms of sight, in terms of smell, in terms of taste. Scientifically, this is proven fact. Women, we find from Bhagavatam, are 9 times more lusty, which means that they are 9 times also more sexually powerful than men. And that sex energy comes out in different ways. So, from sex, from life, from the duration of life, from sensory, women are more powerful. And therefore, they are more dangerous. If the power is misdirected. And in most cases, the power is misdirected. And therefore, one is to be very careful. And therefore, because women are so powerful, women are supposed to be careful themselves in how they direct their power, how they release their power. Women are supposed to be sensitive on their husbands, sons, etc., see men as their sons, and be kind upon them. And so they are to be chaste and to be somewhat subdued, because flamboyant in one extent, because they're supposed to be merciful on the weaker men, on the men species who are weaker. And men are supposed to be careful in knowing the power of attraction that women have. And so, therefore, if the sexes are understanding this, then there is accommodation in terms of helping each other to be Krishna conscious. Just like all the ashrams are necessary to help each ashram. It's hard to have a healthy grihastha ashram if the renounced ashram is not strong. If the brahmacharis and sannyasis are not strong, then it becomes even more difficult for householders because they have less role models, less simplicity and austerity to inspire them, encourage them, etc. And this is why in the Vedic system that the renunciates, the Brahmins, the sannyasis, they would travel and visit the householders, visit the villages, the cities, as a way to inspire people to keep the goal in mind who were having to deal with so much the material nature of such. At the same time, without strong householders, the renounce order will be weak. One order actually facilitates another. And when you have a situation or a community or a project where each ashram is having a chance to be able to express itself authentically with service, with dedication, but at the same time appreciating the other ashram, then each ashram becomes stronger. If you have a front temple or project and there's a very strong presence of brahmacharya, so-called consciousness, but it's insensitive to the householders or insensitive to the fact that people do have different natures and do need to be in different types of relationships, then what will happen is that you'll have brahmacharis who will not really be brahmacharis. They'll be hard-hearted pandits, yogis, and eventually they will make offenses toward each other in their brahmacharya association. They will not develop the softness heart of a bhakta. True brahmacharis were not agitated by grihastha life or sex life or repulsive toward it. They were just innocent and not having any interest because they genuinely were not absorbed or concerned about such. So when there is too much aversion, it's just the opposite of attraction. Too much attraction, then it can be, you know, too much aversion. And so the proper brahmacharya was one who was so fixed in simplicity and dedication and austerity and being the well-wisher of everyone. Not in the mindset of just avoidance or being condescending. We know that that is subtle sex life. And that will later turn into all types of agitation that will cause the brahmachari not to be a brahmachari. And so, therefore, one is to be respectful to Vaishnavas, as we say, vancha kapata rupa dishtra. We're emphasizing that we are to honor all Vaishnavas in whatever forms or deity you may be carrying, a man or a woman. But at the same time, we are to distinctly have and honor Vaishnava etiquette. So that becomes the problem, is that sometimes people want to throw out the etiquette. Or at times the people want to deny the fact that as devotees, we're not interested in being politically correct. We're interested in being transcendental. And we're interested in being sociologically correct for the moment, because that's relative. But at the same time, we are to understand that we're in this world, and we have these bodies, and we have to maintain body and soul together. And to the degree that we have healthy relationships, then there is less lust. So many times, in the Brahmacharya Ashram as well as in the Grihastha Ashram, the lust is so prominent. Lust among Brahmacharis, in the sense of all kinds of arguments and issues of control, just, you know, sex in a subtle form, and sometimes gross. Brahmacharis, sometimes are bachelors more than Brahmacharis. Or sometimes we have householders, and there's just so much excessive involvement in sex life itself, or so much promiscuousness in one part, another part, etc. And so this has to do so much with lust that hasn't been transformed into love. When there's real love and selflessness, then it becomes easier to control the passions, because there's more quality association whenever there is of any type of association. Whether it's brahmacharis and their associations, or husband and wife and their natural conjugal associations. That when there is real affection and love, then there's quality associations. And when there is lust, then there is so much desire for so much different kinds of things because one is not satisfied. Like if you have a good meal, you're satisfied. You don't have to go to other restaurants. You don't have to be, you know, snacking all during the day. But if you're eating and you're not satisfied and you're feeling, I'm still hungry, or you're thinking maybe something else can taste better. And so then there is so much desire to experiment and to be so much involved in the mindset of trying to get some pleasure and stimulation. So because people in all kinds of ways, spiritualists and materialists, are so dissatisfied with their life. So they are so much into looking for something that's going to make them happy. So one person gets married, and marriage didn't work, and they're considering, well, it didn't work because the husband was too old, and so or the wife was too old. And now they marry somebody who's younger. And then that one doesn't work. They say, well, it didn't work because there was financial problems. Now they look for somebody who has wealth, who has money, who has honor. So they're thinking, well, I just didn't find the right connection. But there is no perfect connection in the material world. And we're never going to have a harmonious relationship when whatever it is, single or in your conjugal relationship. We're never going to have anything that's going to be substantial when it's so much based on a selfish orientation. So what is attractive in Krishna's Prabhupada let us know, Krishna is shown by his example, was not just the externals. Those things are powerful, because we see how even Cupid and Shiva themselves were influenced. But what was most prominent was the purity, the quality, the selfless service. So we want more and more to be attractive and to attract others, excuse me, based on our purity and our devotion. And we want to be able to offer to the environment more and more stimulation that helps us in our devotional service than being one who's bringing down the community, bringing down the Krishna conscious culture, minimizing the fact that we're all here as servants of the deities. Whatever our position is, we're here in this community and we are the servants of the deities. And so as we take care of our cars, our house, we do some gardening, as we take care of the cows, as we take care of our children, everything should be in the spirit that this is an offering to Radha Govindandari. or this is an offering to our Easter Day, whatever the deities are, in our particular locale. And the more we're thinking like that, the more we can form great sense of strong teamship as we do our best in trying to make the nicest offering that we can. And so therefore we're even thinking in our relationships that this is part of our offering also. How we serve each other in various ways. So, in summary, here we're seeing Prabhupada saying that one who is pursuing spiritual life should avoid the association of women. And Prabhupada is, and the Bhagavad Gita verse is emphasizing how the women were very attractive. Krishna had so many wives. So how can it be that Krishna can be so attractive to women when women should be avoided, or one should be careful in the association? And so the essence of this is that, yes, they are very powerful and extremely powerful and more powerful in so many ways than men. And a proof of that is how Cupid himself and even Shiva is affected by the form of attractive woman. Of course, this case is incarnation, but it shows the influence. And the contrast is Krishna himself was not attractive, even though the attraction was overwhelming. But what he was attracted to was their, you know, their devotion. And in our constant hearing, we hear how household life is a dark well. We hear how the shackles, Matunya Gaur, the shackles of sex life, binds us. And we hear all of these things and understand, yes, this is what happens when we embrace Griha Medhi life. This is what happens when relationship is not based on spiritual attraction, or is not based on Krishna, keeping Krishna as a center. But to the degree that we are able to put Krishna as the center, then we see that when the Lord descended into this world in his most magnanimous presentation, Namo Nama Vedanaya, Krishna Prema Vedayate, Krishna Krishna Chaitanya, Namne Gaurata Zay Namaha, when he came in such a special way to give the most maximum benefit of love of God in the most simplistic and direct sense, that his associates basically were householders. We see that his primary associates, that they were householders. And we see, and in the line of our so many of our acharyas, that this is also their position. So this helps us to realize more and more that even sex life, according to religious principles, is a way to serve Krishna. And each ashram is a way to serve Krishna, if in fact that is our nucleus, keeping the Lord in the center. And we're not, whatever ashram we're in, that becomes a stagnation if it's not Krishna-centered. And then we discuss how, from a biological, physiological, scientific perspective, women are actually more powerful, more stronger than men in terms of the physical body. We say men are more stronger in physical strength in that sense. But if we look at the duration of ability to endure pain, you look at the life, the longevity of life, and normally you consider if somebody lives longer, that it means somehow their body issues have more power, the organs or whatever, they are able to live longer in general. Everywhere practically on the planet, women live longer than men. That's one of the reasons why polygamy was also allowed, because there's going to be more women than men in most cases, and many men will not be able to take care of a wife. And so the idea was that then some men could take more than one wife, etc. Then we have, and we said, in terms of the workings of the brain, in terms of taste, the vision, sound, that women's bodies are scientifically proven to be more sensitive in these areas, which means that then, being in the material world, they'll be more sensitive to Maya, if, unless there is transformation. So because of that, then it becomes women's duty to be merciful of themselves, to be careful how they exert their energy, and it's men's duty to be careful in trying to associate in the way that's proper. Well, women are like Lakshmi. And so Lakshmi is something everywhere in the world. It is wealth, and it's something that's valuable. But a intelligent and mature person doesn't float or flaunt Lakshmi around.
Some people do.
Some people, they want to brag. They want to show they got gold, they got money. But a cultured person, was not whimsical with their, you know, their assets and whatnot. So women are to be considered like Lakshmi, is that they are supposed to be protected and sacred and not to be flaunted. And when flaunting, then it becomes a disturbance, etc. So Krishna is showing us that attraction really should be based on the devotion. But the attraction is there in many ways. One must try to be more careful that its attraction is going to help with relationship that is liberating and not one, you know, that is incarcerating. There's no such thing as neutral relationships and maturity in one sense, because every relationship, you're either giving something or you're taking something. The question is, what are you giving and what are you taking in the relationship? Is it something that's really helping you or bringing you down? And where it's not helping us, we should be more careful about our associations. Hare Krishna. Any question or any comment? Anyone has? Yes, we should realize more and more that the scriptures are personal, the acharyas are personal, the sadhus are personal. Even though, for instance, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta, Srila Prabhupada, Bhaktivinoda, even though they're no longer physically with us, but their presence, their eternal presence is available, the internal connection is available. And because this is really their movement. Krishna consciousness is actually the movement of Srivastava Kaur, Madhavendra Puri, the movement of Jiva Goswami, Jiva Goswami, it's the movement of Sanatana Goswami. It's really their blessings on this planet. And we are an integral part of that. We are a small interval of such. And so they are distinctly looking after and concern about what goes on. And so when we do something that's proper, we're actually getting blessed by our immediate authorities or guru, as well as by, you know, by the parampara. And we do things that's deviant. We're really sabotaging, weakening what they have tried to make available. We are, you know, giving them pain. There's so many things now that's going on now in the society that's giving Prabhupada all kinds of pain. And so, the more that we're able to kind of personalize what happens, then hopefully it can help us to be, you know, be more sensitive about the choices we make and the way that we hopefully try to control ourselves and the way that we can become, we can rise above, you know, some of the lower pushes. If we are looking a little closer, that what we do is not just going to affect us, going to affect those who've gone before us. It's going to affect particularly those who come after us. It's going to have a lot to do with what we leave, you know, for the children, in that sense. So as we think of this, it can help us that we are either helping, facilitating, or we're bringing, you know, some sadness and pain to each other. Any other question? If someone asked that last night, it's so similar. You know, they're like cousins. Maybe you weren't in the room when it was brought up. But they're like cousins. You know, they have a tendency of going to see together. In both cases, one is feeling very insecure, feeling mistreated, feeling forsaken or abused, and is having some anxiety about what they feel should be coming toward them that isn't coming toward them. And so it's just heavy positions of insecurity. And many people, you know, are much more needy than others. For some people, the slightest thing, they you know, become jealous or envious. And often people are envious and jealous who are not very faithful themselves. So that people who have a tendency to be devious themselves have a very hard time trusting someone else. And then other times, someone doesn't trust another because that person has done things that has taken away from their trust. And because of that, they are more prone to be, say, to be jealous because they know of what, you know, the other person can actually do or what the other person can actually accept from someone else. Someone knows that my husband, my wife, does not play into other people's energies. And then they have no reason to be so envious or jealous because even when something is going on, some funny exchange, the person knows my wife distinctly keeps boundaries. But if something's happened in the past, that was a problem, then one will have fear of one is seen that somebody is playing, you know, a lot with subtle energies. And then the person becomes angry or disturbed. It's like in general, woman can sense even more than a man when her man, her husband, is being attracted to or some other woman is making some passes. So sometimes the man is being a little naive and not seeing it. The woman knows because she does the same thing herself or can do the same thing. But she sees, come on. She's not just being kind to you. Something else is there. And you know, sometimes there's excessive fear. But in many cases, it's because we do often have a tendency to not keep psychological space in our relationships. That's why it would be very good when we honor who is proper for sannyas, we could actually have women on the board. Huh? because they can help us to know. Huh? I remember once one very famous brahmachari surprised everybody and fell down. The men were surprised, but the women weren't. Because the women knew all along he was doing his wonderful kirtan, he was playing for them. Huh? Women knew all along, yeah? That there was this soy type of mentality that was mixed in such a way. Any last question? Yes.
In summary, can we say that the woman's body is described in the Bhagavatam as more lusty and less intelligent, mm-hmm. because the woman's body is more connected to the material nature.
Exactly.
And because of that, the attraction is greater to material nature. Mm-hmm. So whereas man, their connection with material nature is not so much except the connection to women. The attraction to women. So when they give up this attraction to women, then it's easier for them to draw their attraction to their affection to Krishna. Can you say it like that?
That can happen. It can happen both ways. We see that because a man can be very attracted to a woman, in some cases the woman is more spiritual. So this may keep the man as a devotee. It may keep the man involved in service. It may encourage him. Because women have amazing power to inspire. They have amazing power to annihilate and destroy someone also. And so, as women realize more and more the power that they have, they can play a huge role in making this movement, an action struggle movement. It's like in the world in general. So much of what is going on is the macho power of men in a combative mood, etc., etc. And so, there's a need for more feminine energy. Now, feminine energy doesn't mean feminine form, necessarily. Women are more caretakers of the feminine energy. But there's a need for more feminine energy so that there's more nurturing and also caring, in that sense. The women have more responsibility and overseeing internationally, you know, our gurukulas. We in Norway would have had as much abuse of children, you know, as we've had in such ways. Because there's been naturally much more setting up things for providing more protection, and they would have been sharing more of their own nurturing energy that would have balanced some of the energies, you know, that was going on in such a way. And so, you know, it's there that the energy of women is to be feared if it's not used in the proper way. And Bhagavatam explains. You know, when a woman becomes angry, becomes envious, she's ready, she can destroy you. Can hold grudges like anything. And sometimes women, men can have grudges also, you know. And in Kali Yuga, there's not a huge difference, in some cases, because there's so much of a mixture of roles, so much confusion also. But but that is another sign, is that when a woman really appreciates someone, she can really give herself real dedication, determination, etc. And women know, as men know. And when a woman has Martin as an enemy, she can hold that forever and ever and ever. It's us. But if she feels that, if she feels cared for and protected, then she can dedicate herself like anything. That's why even now, you know, some dictators and tyrants, they are more and more trained up women for security. Because they know that a woman who's really loyal will give her life even faster sometimes than a man, in that sense. It's been proven that women are more honest, you know, in working in banks. But they have to deal with, you know, lots and lots of money. Because somehow if they are feeling that they're secure, they feel that they're in a secure position, they feel that they are valued, then they'll be much more loyal. Well, the man's tendency, you know, could change a little more, you know. I mean, these are generalities. But in general, woman is more stronger when it comes to mature energy. And that can be, destabilizing and can bring all kinds of help. But the energy is directed properly, then it can do all kinds of things in bringing about healing and empowering and inspiring, you know, someone, you know, in so many ways. So, women, you be kind and merciful to all the men.
Still, we see that women are exploited in our society. So, how is it that women are actually more powerful, but then on the other hand, they're being exploited by men?
Because the men have the weapons, they have the money, they have more facilities. And that's why women, in general, are actually more depressed. They're more prone for depression. Because life becomes harder when you have less ability to control the variables in your life. And life becomes harder when you have to live a life with more fear and more paranoia. A man can walk down almost any street, almost, and not really have to worry. You think a woman, alone, anywhere, in most cases, has to have healthy paranoia. I mean, it has to be afraid. Or has to have, you know, some sensitivity. A man can meet another man, meet a woman, and just greet them, and there's no problem. A woman greeting someone has to also do some mental gymnastic. Is this person going to think something more than what I really want, you know, to send out? You know? A woman has to be more concerned about being attacked, about being raped, all these kind of things. And so it's difficult in that sense when you think about it. Look at all of that, and then you look at that. In most cases, women are discriminated. In most cases, woman who knows the same that a man knows is not as likely to get the same job. In most cases, woman who knows the same a man does is not likely to get the same payment in most environments. And so in general, you know, women are discriminated against. And this is one of the reasons we know that civilization suffers. When cows, women, children, elderly persons are not cared for, then it brings all kind of inauspiciousness. And one may say it may have something to do with men's lifespan getting shorter because of the fact that women are more prone to be abused than not. Now, the unfortunate thing is that because of such, women often put themselves in positions to become abused. Or women often will get in positions, become abusers themselves. Worst thing you have to deal with sometimes is a woman judge, a woman, you know, bank president, because in many cases, that woman has worked extra hard to get that position. And now in the process has internalized so much masculinity, has put on hold her femininity, and often will be harsh and more insensitive and more demanding than the man who has the same post. Sometimes when, you know, in the past we have to go through borders, a lot of times, you know, like in the communist countries in the early days, You have to be very sensitive, and we can sometimes we have to sort of try to choose which place to go. And many times, one would be careful to avoid going to a woman who's in authority, because she's going to be more scrutinizing, going to be more intense, because she has to show that she deserves that post. Or she gets that post because she has been shrewd because of the kind of culture that the men have created. But it's very important that when women do get positions, that they don't give up their femininity in the process of trying to show their excellence or their achievement, or in trying to show that they're competent in such ways. And unfortunately, you know, that happens more than not when there's a need for healthy balance. We see, I try to see Prabhupada, then I better stop. You see how Prabhupada had the mood of like, you know, like a Bengali mother. And that he was a very caring and compassionate person. But at the same time, you know, he was, you know, very vigilant and had a lion type of mindset and mood as well, and dealing with the Mayavadis and the personas and whatnot. But Prabhupada had this softness in this way. And so as we become genuinely more spiritual, there is a healthy balance between the masculine and feminine energies within our consciousness. Because there's a natural mood of protection and a natural mood, you know, also of nurturing. So there's a healthier balance between the woman's own physical body as well as in the man's physical body. Not that it's we're talking about, I guess, gay or homosexuality. That's a thing of its own. But the fact that as we become more spiritual, we do have this orientation where both aspects is very prominent. The masculine aspect as well as the feminine aspect. Because we are going outside of the body and nourishing the soul. And the soul is awesome. I mean, we see the gopis, they are very feminine, but they're also very aggressive. They're very powerful. They can out-chant and out-dance the men. Huh? Gopis are playing with dangas, you know? They're jumping up in trees and having kirtan. They're arranging things. At the same time, they're extremely attractive, extremely feminine, but they're, you know, they're powerful. They know so much, they're shouting, but at the same time, they're very humble in this way. And the cowherd boys are similar. They are very chivalrous, they're very prominent, dominant. At the same time, it's almost like a feminine energy in the cowherd boys as well. There's this duality of balance in such ways. Because the concern is how to serve. And therefore, whatever it takes, it comes into action, service. If it's more of a masculine energy for service, okay. If it's more of a feminine for service, it's okay. It comes forth. So we have a program this evening at Byron Bay, and then I get my last class tomorrow morning. Maybe tomorrow. Tomorrow I think is Varaha's appearance or disappearance. Appearance of Varaha's appearance. Okay. It's time for the charge of divine grace. A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. A.C. Radha Gopadandara Ji Ki.
And then there's also, for those of you who have the joy of being on the internet,